Hey, C-Lab fans, listen up, because I've got some great news for you. All over, executives are scrambling to find effective ways to retain customers and increase product engagement. What's the solution? Training customers right from the start. But without the proper tools, that's easier said than done. So let me tell you about Gainsight CE, the game changer in digital customer education. Gainsight CE blends the dynamic nature of digital learning with the importance of meeting those intrinsic human needs that accelerate user adoption, deepen product understanding, and drive customer success, all without sacrificing that personalized attention your customers long for. Say goodbye to time-consuming and hard-to-track one-on-one trainings, endless emailings of PDFs, and help center links. And the best part, your learning program can be embedded seamlessly in your platform. Don't take my word for it. Industry leaders like Walmart, Pipedrive, Glassdoor, and Freshworks choose Gainsight CE for their customer training program. So get started today. Visit gainsight.com/customer-education and tell them Adam and Dave sent you.
Welcome to C-Lab, the customer education lab, where we explore how to build customer education programs, experiment with new approaches, and exterminate the myths and bad advice that stop growth dead in its tracks. I'm Adam Avramescu. I got so nervous, I couldn't say my own name. I'm Adam Avramescu, and I am nervous because I am here today with Mindy Barenblatt. Hi, Mindy.
Hello, Adam.
It's great to have you on the show today, and I will introduce you to our listeners in a moment and tell you why I'm so excited to have you here. But first, I have a very important question.
I'm ready.
Okay. We're recording this right now towards the end of the year. It's it's the holiday season, and let's say you have your ideal choice of activities. Option one is you can sing a song. And option two is you can enjoy a sangria. Which one of those two would you pick?
Sangria.
You would pick sangria. Okay. Well, Then happy National Sangria Day to you, Mindy.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It is both National Sangria Day and National Go Caroling Day. So, depending on your choice, you could do both.
In fact, you could be better at the caroling after enjoying the Sangria Day celebration.
Good point. Although what I've found as I've gotten out of my prime karaoke days is that the moment I have, more than one drink in me and I start singing, I'm going to shred my vocal cords a lot more easily than I used to. Mm-hmm. So I generally wake up sounding like I'm about to make like a mob deal or something like that.
I made an offer I can't refuse.
Forget about it.
Forget about it. Okay. Gabagool.
So, Mindy, you and I got in touch when I put a call out in LinkedIn for people who have experience with customer education, pricing, and packaging. And the reason that I wanted to talk about this is we were going back and looking at our New Year's resolutions from last year. And we actually said this was one of the topics that we wanted to cover more on the show. And of course, like any good person who manages his time well, on the 20th of December, I put the call out on LinkedIn to make sure that we could get some good recommendations to have an episode. So first of all, thank you for helping me get in under the line.
I mean, it's not New Year's Eve, so you are exceeding expectations.
Fair enough. It's a topic that we haven't covered in a while. We have visited it before on the show, but it's one that our listeners have asked for and where I think we have a lot of meaningful discussion that is worth it to keep revisiting. And so I'm really glad that you were recommended on LinkedIn as someone that I should talk to because, in fact, for listeners who might not know Mindy is based in Austin, Texas, my former hometown, and is currently an education and enablement strategist and consultant. But before that, Mindy was a general manager and VP of education services for Blackbaud. And before that, she's at Eloqua.
Just Eloqua. Say it over and over again and a fairy gets its wings. Eloqua.
Okay. It's ironic, right? Because you want to be eloquent when you say it.
You do. And yet I think it's memorable, right? You're just like, qua, yeah. Quo, qua. Yeah. Eloquent.
Well, so like, I know the sounds that should be coming out of my mouth, but I'm not sure of the emphasis on which syllable I should be putting it within
fair.
The name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally so Eloquent, which then became Oracle or I guess was brought into Oracle Marketing Cloud Academy. Yep, was zipped up.
Yep.
Among other roles in training and education. And so maybe we can start there, right? Like you were the GM for a large revenue generating education services business. Can I say the number or am I not allowed to say that?
You can.
For a $36 million revenue generating education services business. So maybe I'd love to start with hearing about your path towards there. Like, how did you get into the role and how did you, build it from wherever the business was when you first came in to getting to that point?
Absolutely. So I'd been in instructional design and customer education for a while before I joined Blackbaud. And I actually joined to run their instructional design team. At the time, it was a single team, 10 people covering five products. And I managed that team. We grew the curriculum to over 20 different products. And then I ended up taking over as the GM of the education services business. We increased revenue about $16 million in the 8 years that I was there. And it was definitely a learning journey. When I first started in instructional design for software, I had the absolute luxury of only supporting one product. Mm-hmm. If you support one product, just revel in the joy that is focus. And so figuring out how to support such a wide portfolio and what is needed, both from pricing, packaging, amount of content, for a lot of different types of products and a lot of different price points. It's a fun problem to have, but definitely a robust problem.
Yeah. And maybe to make this a little bit more real, can you give some examples of the types of products that you're talking about here?
Sure. So Blackbaud is a social good software company, and they have fundraising software that is essentially CRM, but for fundraising. They've got financial software for 501c3s. They've got corporate giving and volunteering. They've got foundation software, peer-to-peer. So there is a wide variety. The other piece that's interesting is many Blackbaud customers own multiple products that all integrate together, but it means that they might have five or six products. And so the experience needed to be fairly consistent across branding, types of classes, types of experiences, because you knew that the same person might purchase multiple different products, multiple different subscriptions for education to go with each product.
Yeah, that definitely adds some complexity, right? Because on one hand, you have to make sure that the offerings that you're putting out there match the nature of the product that you're training on. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, you also have to make sure that they're consistent enough with each other that if a customer selects multiple, you're not like, oh, and you get like this random thing that doesn't match with this other random thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So like maybe we can actually orient that towards, like, let's talk about it from the customer's perspective. When you were offering these education services, what were the main customer needs or pain points that you were solving with your training offerings? And maybe tell me about like where you saw the highest demand from customers.
So in the nonprofit realm specifically, turnover is typically 18 months. So people are not at jobs for a really long time. Now that's a gross generalization. There are people that are in the same job, same organization for, you know, decades, but there is a lot of turnover. And so that perpetual upskilling is really important. The other piece that's really important in this space is that there are people that join a nonprofit or a foundation because they love the mission. They don't always have the expertise in marketing, development, fundraising, big gift, major end of year campaigns. And so we had an opportunity to not just say, what outcomes are you trying to achieve with the software, but also what are the best practices of these different aspects that people who use our software really need to stay abreast of and potentially learn for the first time if they are kind of doing this as a passion and less of a, you know, I was a CMO and now I'm going to run marketing for this nonprofit.
Okay. So I'm hearing professional development. I'm hearing like onboarding for new members of existing accounts and then presumably implementation as well.
Oh, absolutely. Sorry. So implementation is like
the classic,
the biggest. And I jumped right over it because I assume all of us are supporting implementation.
That's the classic training services use case, right?
And I would say when I joined, implementation was seen as kind of the use case. And there was definitely not the buy-in from the rest of the company that education was as useful beyond that. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest, I think, wins of my time there was the team really shifted that perspective to where sales and success and marketing all understood the value that education brought that went way beyond implementation.
That is really interesting. And we'll come back and talk about sales and marketing in a moment, but like, actually let's spend a moment there. How did you, I guess, manage to build the case for education as being for more than just implementation?
So some of it was when I came in, there was a hodgepodge of curricula. Some of it, I will say, might not have been touched in literally 10 years. And so it was not the most enjoyable education experience. And so some of it was, we've got to get this content to a place where people are enjoying taking the classes. And then we have to entice our employees and our internal stakeholders to give us another chance. Let's relook at this curriculum, take a quick class, audit a class, get certified, reintroduce them. A lot of this is about repetition. How many times can I be in front of everyone in this company talking about here's what's changed, here's what people are saying? I would also say we started doing a about yearly survey to our customers to say, hey, what benefit did you see from taking our instructor-led classes in the last year? And clearly, working within our own bias, we only sent it to people who took instructor-led training in the last year. But the responses to that were very clear. And on average, every single year, we would get, taking these classes has saved me 4 to 6 hours every week. That data point was so compelling because it speaks to the pain points that the salesperson is actually hitting up against, right? We don't have time to implement new software. We don't have time to take classes. We don't have time, you know, there's always this time piece. Nonprofits are classically underserved and under employed. And so people are wearing a lot of different hats. And so to be able to say, look at this, take some classes and then take an hour for lunch every day and walk away from your computer and like take care of yourself or be able to launch that next campaign, right? Like there's just so much. And a lot of the people in the nonprofits have so much heart for what they're doing. It's very easy for people to get burned out. And so saying invest, yes, it's going to take some time up front. The dividend is actually ultimately going to help you drive your mission in a sustainable way. So having that kind of data point, really important. Other data points that were key, we're starting to link training consumption to larger business outcomes and saying, hey, people who complete training, more likely to renew the product.
Yeah,
seems like that's our goal, right? That's why we're here. We want customers not just to pay the customer acquisition cost, but also keep them and renew them. So that seems like a good plan. So I think it was repetition. Give us another try once the content was kind of really lovely and beautified and a much better interactive hands-on experience. And then having the right data point for the audience that I'm speaking to. What do they care about? And how do I translate the value that I see for my customers, but translate it for that person so that they care, the what's in it for me?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, first of all, that you were having your trainees self-report their productivity, right? Because that's already, I think, a good proof point to, like, it's like social proof for other people who might take that class in the future and actually understand what's in it for them. So like the argument behind that, just so I understand that, is essentially like, because we're teaching you more ways that you can get value from our software and we can actually make you more productive, we are going to save you this amount of time that you would otherwise spend either by using our software inefficiently or by just doing other or random manual things that you could actually, yeah, now do with our software.
Yep. I'm a big LeVar Burton fan, so you don't have to take my word for it. Like, that was the whole idea of that survey. Let the customers speak for us. Smaller percentage, but we also saw, hey, you helped us increase fundraising. You helped us renew donors. You helped us. And so we could lean into these different proof points that and use them in the moments when they made the most sense.
So in other words, just take a look. It's in a book.
Exactly. Reading Rainbow. Yeah.
Oh, you okay. You do want to sing.
It was a stealth music episode.
Love it. Okay.
Only for LeVar.
Only for LeVar. Okay. Yeah. Fair. We all have boundaries. Maybe one more question on the correlation to renewal rates. That's a really interesting one as well. And in general, we're always trying to map our education program activity to business outcomes. So makes a lot of sense. When we talk about correlations, sometimes we get challenged on how do you know that that was correlation and not reverse causation? So how do you like how do we know we're not saying that customers who would have renewed anyway are the ones who were more likely to want training? Did you get that sort of pushback?
I did. And I think, honestly, one of the best ways to counteract that is to upfront say, hey, I have some really interesting correlations. And to be clear, I cannot prove that I am the only reason this happened. But if I'm looking at 120,000 training completions and renewal data that is just as robust, then A, I have a very strong Excel love. And B, that correlation says something. Now, I will tell you, for the products where, hey, the data is lean here, right? So that correlation is a little bit weaker. But in this product, we have a ton of data. And I think it's meaningful enough to say people who understand the product are more likely to renew. Now, that feels like Captain Obvious just landed. But it really helped, because I think the very first time I did this data, the CFO was like, well, but you can't prove it. Da, 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 da. And so the next time I came back with that data, I said, well, but I've worked with your finance team. I know that I can't prove this. And yes, the person who takes training is more motivated to learn and therefore more motivated to renew. And yet, let's look at the data. Let's look at how much data there is. And the correlation is really strong. Because on some of these products, it would be like 23 points more likely to renew. And I'm like, even if I'm only responsible for 10 of those points, I think you want 10 point increase in renewal rate.
Yeah.
So I find that radical candor and being really upfront about here's what the data says very clearly, here's where the limit of that clarity is, and let's look at it.
Yeah. Someone put it the other day, like they said, customer education is a strategy more so than a science, right? Like specifically thinking like the reason why you want to collect this data in the first place is not to have a completely rigorous view of like exact causality. Like you can do regression analyses and you can like start to support yourself with more evidence. But really the reason why you're investing in customer education has to be to some extent because you believe that it's going to generate these outcomes for customers. And you can observe that in ways that aren't this like perfectly scientific, methodologically rigorous way, which frankly is a standard that we tend to hold ourselves to in customer education that very few other business disciplines actually hold themselves to.
And I would also say, because I was trying to think, what's the other reason? Because I will admit, it was a lovely environment where executives all the way down, by the time I left, thoroughly on board with the power of education and wanting to get it in front of more people. Mm-hmm. I think the other piece was how happy we made our customers to the point where we would get feedback of, oh man, I love having a health score call with customers that have done training. Like it's just, it's a better call. They know what they're talking about. They're happier. Their questions are more informed. And that kind of anecdotal happiness has a lot of power as well. Yeah. Because I think as much as we love to be data-driven, we also need that emotional component that says learning should be joyful. When there is joy, there is increased learning and retention, or at least positive affect. It doesn't have to be all the way to joy, but
no, but like talking about joy and being able to show that I guess that the emotional side of it and being able to storytell a little bit around it. Like if you're purely trying to justify your investment in the causal relationship between training and these other things, like I feel like you're making the wrong argument because it's not actually what training does best. Like you don't invest in customer education because it is the single thing that drives these outcomes. You invest in it because it has a dispersed impact on several outcomes, can be done more efficiently than most of them, most of the other ones, and if done correctly, creates an emotional connection with customers that enhances the effect of those outcomes. So I think like that's the argument you want to be making, not going so far down the line of like, I am going to prove causation.
And to be fair, like take a step back and look at education. I am not invested in my children's education for the report card. Education is about long-term investment and growth and development and understanding that goes way beyond a number. And I'm not saying that we're trying to instill social emotional learning and like the things that elementary and, you know, K through 12 is doing are incredible, but the data tells a piece of the story.
Exactly. Agreed. Exactly. Yeah. And I don't think either of us are saying like, don't go collect that data, but it's more about thinking about having a few key data points that combined with the qualitative data and the effect that you can show of those dispersed effects around the business and the feedback that you're getting from your customers, like use that all in tandem to tell the story. Don't assume that you're someday just going to come up with some like incontrovertible proof point that shows that education caused all of these outcomes.
Right. Yes.
It's probably not going to happen. Okay. So we got off on a huge tangent here, but it's an important one. And it's one of the most frequent questions that we get, you know, from customer education professionals and leaders. So I think like really good to hear your perspective on it. Let's go back to, you were talking about instructor-led training a moment ago.
Yes.
So I would like to hear a little bit about what was the mix of services you had? And
absolutely.
You know, kind of like knowing the timeline that you were there, tell me about how that shifted during COVID.
Oh, yeah. The gift that COVID brought all of us. I would not wish it on the globe again. And yet there were definitely some interesting learnings from that time that I don't think would have happened otherwise. Total caveat, but I saw early on during COVID a tweet that said, who is leading digital transformation? And it listed like CFO, CEO, CCO, or COVID. And I was like, yeah, COVID is getting us all to transform digitally.
Yeah.
Okay, but offerings. I can stay focused every once in a while. So when I joined, it was instructor-led training offered virtually. So we had a public calendar of classes. By the time I left, we were offering about 150 classes every week. So that schedule was pretty robust and had, you know, a wide variety of products and levels of classes. There was some e-learning when I joined. That piece really had to be overhauled and invested in. We launched certifications for the products that really warranted them. And
high stakes, proctored, all that good stuff?
Oh, Lord, no. Not at all. So these were really meant to be milestones of achievement. So the first one was the fundamentals level exam. Hey, you've taken kind of the introductory set of classes, take this exam. Almost it was more, if you've taken these classes and paid attention, you should be able to pass it. we would many times use it for people that said that they didn't need to take fundamentals. And we would say, go take the exam and let's figure out which classes you might need to brush up on, or maybe you're ready to jump into advanced classes. So it was more of a threshold of, yeah,
you were almost using it to like test your own level and figure out where you needed to jump it. So it's probably like what a real cert head would call an ABC, like an assessment-based certificate, more so than like a capital C certification.
I definitely learned when we were acquired into Oracle, because we had certifications that Oracle said, no, those are not certifications. Those are low stakes. And we were like, okay, sorry. So correct. These were definitively more of a learning tool, directional tool. And then we would have some advanced certifications as well. Again, they weren't the end all be all. They're not going to prove that someone should be hired, that kind of thing. And yet, great way to validate. Are you staying up to date? You can retake it every year. It's included in your subscription. You might find something that is new in there and it'll guide you to the right class to go brush up on.
If you want to grow your business, you need to educate and engage your customers at every point of the funnel. So Thinkific Plus can help you do just that with their powerful learning platform that's so easy to use. Thinkific Plus believes that customer education can combat the common challenges of recurring revenue, like churn. So, Thinkific Plus has created a purpose-built platform for agile teams that allows you to create impactful educational experiences for your customers. That means you can find new ways to engage with them, you can drive adoption, renewals, expansion, and growth, everything that a business cares about. So, reimagine education for your customers' success with Thinkific Plus. You can get 1 month of Thinkific Plus for free with our special code. Go to thinkific.com/CELABS. That's thinkific.com/CLABS.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So, you had that, and like, let's talk about maybe how you mapped the different training offerings to the different product offerings, right? So like, did everything have all of those different offerings?
Great question.
Were there some that had only like, I don't know, like some components?
So I mentioned that we were covering five products when I first joined, and ultimately all of those had all of those layers. Those were what I would consider big kid products, large customer base, and robust products that really warranted a pretty deep level of content. As we expanded the portfolio, there were definitively products that were much simpler, much cheaper, didn't warrant more than an hour or two of education content total. You can't build an exam off of that. Nor do you want to. And quite honestly, a lot of those products, the price point wouldn't warrant the cost of instructor-led training. And so we just said, let's just do free e-learning for some of these lighter products. And then for the deeper products at a slightly higher price point where that customer base would say, yes, I can invest in education, make those have the instructor-led training. We also offered any subscription would have access to our best practices instructor-led classes. And so there were kind of these, sometimes a medium-sized product where it needed more than just what was free, but it wasn't as deep as some of the ones where the price point would be completely justified just on product classes. And so we had this layer of best practices workshops that went across a majority of our products that any subscription would get the value from that. And so it would take that medium-sized product curriculum and give it more meat because we were trying to sell learn subscriptions. So that subscription, so sell it for 3 years and have them renew. You've got to have value for them to keep renewing. And some of that is having content there and having some depth and having some interesting things release. And then some of it is that they'll have turnover and they need to start over again.
Yeah. Yeah. So they have to keep educating people on their own account.
Yep.
Okay. So like, let's talk about these subscriptions, because I think this is an interesting component of packaging, because some people like to do everything a la carte. Some people do bundle into subscriptions. There's a million ways you can package your learning offerings. But let's talk about like, kind of how did the subscriptions work? Maybe was it at the account level or at the individual level? Did you have to purchase a different subscription per product? Like, just take me a step deeper into what these subscriptions were.
So the Learn subscriptions were sold at the organization level. And so it was all you can eat for one product. So let's say you have product A, okay. Then you purchase Learn subscription for product A. Then you purchase product B, then you purchase Learn B. And anyone at that organization could log in and take classes. Realistically, it's going to be the people who use the product that mm-hmm. log in and take the classes. So there was a bit of a natural buffer around, like, we're not going to have 300 people show up for a product class if they don't use that product, right? So there's some kind of...
So you could still kind of capacity plan even for your instructor-led classes, roughly how many people would show up, because you could still say, okay, if this organization purchases this product, then I can assume I have this number of people
on average, they'll have this many this users. Class. Yeah.
Okay, so you didn't have to worry about like super rate limiting it or anything like that.
Right. And at the time, we didn't really have a mechanism to do named users or limit or, and so it was, we're just going to make this all you can eat. And that's part of the value, is that we can say, hey, you've purchased a finance software, but you have somebody in marketing that wants to take these best practices classes, they can. We're here to help upskill across the different departments. And there's value in that. So it was all you can eat, and it was per product. I'm trying to think of what, there was one other aspect that you mentioned.
I said, is it all you can eat? Was it the organizational level? Was it per product? I don't remember what the other question I asked in the middle of that is, but I guess the other question that I would ask is, like, were there other offerings that lived outside of the subscription? So, for example, were there certain things where, okay, beyond the all you can eat, there was another premium or like upsell product if you wanted, I don't know, like private training or yep. like we fly on site to you or something like that.
Okay. Yes. A la carte and COVID. Those are my two keywords to remember. So, okay.
You don't want COVID a la carte. That would be a very unhappy lunch.
Oh, that's so true. We need to rework that phrasing.
Yeah, so true, bestie.
So when I joined, about 8 to 10% of the revenue was private training. At no point while I was there was a la carte a significant part of our revenue. We tried to price in such a way where, hey, if you take a couple classes a la carte, you're already well on your way towards a year-long subscription price. So the idea was we would actually look at the end of each month and say, who's purchased something a la carte? Hey, it looks like this is the second class they've purchased a la carte. Should we reach out to them and say, hey, if you're going to take a few more classes this year, would you be interested in purchasing mm-hmm. a Learn subscription? We'll put that money towards the subscription, that kind of move. So a la carte was there and helpful, but not a main revenue driver. Private training was a pretty big revenue driver. And when I first joined, one-time revenue was a lever that was enjoyed more. As I was there, there was a really big drive to have more and more recurring revenue just at the corporate level, having more things recurring. And so
yeah, especially because then, like, when you're reporting on your recurring revenue versus your one-time revenue, it's reported differently to the street, and it actually becomes something that businesses have to target a certain mix of.
And so, when COVID hit, the piece that I forgot to mention because COVID wiped it out is we had public classroom training, and there were actually two tiers of the Learn subscription, and the highest tier included access to these public classroom trainings. And it was a big driver for people because we had consistently about 15 cities worldwide where we would offer classes sometimes once a quarter, sometimes more than that if there was demand. And there was just, hey, we can go meet other people from our area, kind of like a miniature learning conference. That was one of the big changes that COVID bestowed upon us. Obviously, public classroom training went out the window. During COVID, many of the vendors who provided that kind of service just kind of went out of business. And it was not a margin-friendly effort to be offering this versus virtual. And so COVID pretty much wiped that out, and we needed to find new ways of providing value to that top-tier subscription. We actually launched kind of a series of masterclass-style thought leaders doing interviews and really high-quality video. You know, hey, what have you learned? What would you share? Expanding some of our best practice workshops, that kind of thing, to add more value into that tier. But by the time I was leaving, we were 98-99% recurring revenue. Private training pretty much went away during COVID. We did some virtual private training, but it was, you know, not a big draw, because if you get a subscription, you could have that virtual experience included in the subscription.
Yeah, because before, in the world before, just to confirm, like, what private training meant was, like, you were going on site to a specific client, and the value was really, like, being in the room with them, not just tailoring the content to their needs. Correct. So once you remove, if you keep the tailoring, but you remove the everyone's on site together, it probably loses some of its appeal.
And just the sheer price point of, you know, hey, you can pay one subscription price, cover everyone in your organization, or ultimately you're going to need this subscription to continually learn and pay for private training that is delivered virtually and is very similar to what you get in the subscription. Is it worth it? So by late 21, definitely in 22, we saw private training starting to make a comeback, usually around go live for larger organizations, still wanting to gather people together in a room, fly somebody out. But realistically, a lot of the organizations were now hybrid or working remotely. They would have to rent a room for a large group of people to gather, right? Yeah. They don't have the office space. And so while I do think private training will continue to come back, I don't expect that it's going to come back to the levels that it was before COVID.
Yeah, that we made that prediction as well, I think, in our last year-end episode. So you're helping to validate that.
I'm here to validate you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we need validation. So maybe last question from a packaging angle, because we'll come back to pricing in a moment, but maybe this will help bridge us actually, is like, I'm curious about what you did with some of this more, like you talked about some products only having free e-learning or only having basic level training. Like how did that relate to the subscriptions? Were there some products where you didn't need the subscription because there was only free stuff available? For the products that did have subscriptions, could people still access free basic e-learning? Just tell me about what the relationship was, I guess, between those.
So before COVID, some e-learning was completely free and available to everybody. Some was still held kind of behind the subscription paywall. At the very beginning of COVID, we saw a huge spike in consumption. A lot of nonprofits had to kind of shudder and figure out how to work in this remote world. And so these workers that never had time to take a class suddenly said, you know what? I actually have time right now. Let me take advantage of this and take some classes. And our consumption spiked way up. And in response, we said, you know what? What if we made all of the basic e-learning completely free, accessible to everybody? Let's, you know, it's still our customers. It's still in an LMS, but is it worth it to try and gate this? Or can we just say, hey, in response to COVID, let's, you know, just gift this? Great thing to do. Having that be, removing that barrier also meant that many of our internal stakeholders no longer had this anxiety of, can I recommend training without feeling like I'm selling to someone because I'm not sure if this person, what they own. Right. And so knowing that that free level was there, they could still say, yes, absolutely. Go check out, you know, Blackbaud University, and there's some great stuff available to you. And, you know, that removing that barrier internally was, I think, just as important as the external barrier. So when I think about a leader would come to me and say, my product needs training, I would say, okay, we are but finite humans with only so much time in a day. And the fact that you have a need, I understand, but we also need to continue to maintain and build what we already have. And so sometimes it was a, do we have bandwidth to take on another product? Do we need investment headcount in order to take on another product? But most of the time it was, well, let's sit down and really do a deep dive on what you need. What are the training needs? And doing an outline of, hey, to upskill a new user, how long would it take you if you were just going to sit there and talk them through it? You know, like, what would you be talking about? Just to get that sense of, are we talking about an hour-long call or weeks of hour-long calls, right? And yeah, that would start to help me differentiate, is this just something that we can easily cover in a few basic e-learning titles, or is there a lot of depth here that we need more? The other piece was, what is your product priced at? And does that customer base have room for two more dollars, right? So if they're paying $49 a month for the software, there's not a lot of leeway to add a paid offer on top of that that would cover cost, yeah, right? Versus, you know, hey, your MRR is several hundred, several thousand. There's plenty of space and typically a little bit of budget. And also an understanding, like somebody who purchases a more expensive software, it's typically a little bit more of a mature organization that understands you may have to invest in order to go deeper, and not just kind of this mom and pop pulling everything together, like barely out of Excel kind of thing. So both are great. They're both doing amazing good in the world. But in terms of making sure that we're offering the right thing, it's about, what does the customer need? What does the product need? What does the business need? What will the market actually bear?
So like this really gets us into, I think, now the meat of moving from packaging to pricing. So let's talk about it. Let's be candid, right? You had free offerings, you had paid offerings. Some things were in the subscription. Some things were just included in the software license cost. Right. How did you approach pricing for all of these different offerings? And, you know, thinking about finding that tricky line or spectrum between free and paid.
Oh, so much joy in pricing. And I will say, when I joined, pricing was usually just a percentage of software cost, where software costs X, the Learn subscription at that tier for that product will be this percentage. You know, somewhere in the 15 to 20, 25% of that would be the price point. What I think the big limitation to that is, it needed a floor and a ceiling. So going through the exercise of, how much does it actually cost us to support the average organization is really important. How many users does the average organization for that product have? How many classes do we think they need to take in order to get through implementation? How many do they need to take to upskill a new user? How many they, like, start making some assumptions about what their consumption ideally looks like. In a lot of cases, when it was looking at, hey, here's the price right now, but we need to do a reprice because some of it's gotten a little wonky and out of whack. Then we could actually draw from, what is the actual consumption of an average org look like? And we figured out marginal cost per seat. So how much does it cost us if there's 15 to 18 people in every instructor-led session? You know, what does it cost us to actually deliver that session?
Yep.
And knowing what the cost is, and then looking at, well, what does that mean for the price point? What kind of margin are you aiming for or expected to have? Because there's very different scenarios where you as a leader are trying to break even. You as a leader are just proving that you're worth investing in. You as a leader are driving a high margin business, right? So that's a key piece of pricing. And then I think about magazines. I realize most of us probably magazines anymore.
Can you say that word again?
Magazine.
Haven't heard of it. Okay.
I understand. Yes. paper folded over glossy, pretty pictures delivered via snail mail with interesting little tidbits that you care about. But
okay, how does this relate to magazines?
Say, right. So if you purchase one magazine, maybe it's $5 or $6, but oh, you can get a year of this magazine for $15, right? So from a sales perspective, they need to be able to justify this cost and say, well, we expect most organizations would take about 5 to 7 classes a year and look at the a la carte pricing. A la carte times 5 to 7, oh, that's cheaper than the subscription price, right? If that subscription price required them to take hundreds of hours of a la carte training every year in order to hit that price, it's not justified. That's where you need to have that ceiling that it's not reasonable just because you have tons of contacts and need a really large CRM that your education price scales all the way to, you know, 15% of that software price. That doesn't make sense. You'll never consume enough training to make that work. So you kind of have to look at it through the lens of what can the business bear? What is the cost, right? Because you're not trying to be a loss leader, or at least you're probably not trying to be a loss leader. I wasn't. What are the expectations for profitability? What does the customer actually need? Is it sellable? Are you perpetually undercut by a competitor that all of the training is free? Is that their main differentiator? Well, then let's look at, are we pricing education in a way where we're actually boxing ourselves out of opportunity, right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of going back to that conversation around tying the education services to other parts of the business, making sure you understand, hey, revenue essentially puts a wall in front of some of the enablement or all of the enablement. Is that wall actually causing more pain where people are hitting it rather than getting across the wall and flourishing, renewing, becoming better superstar users?
This episode is brought to you by Intellum. You know Intellum, we've had them on the show before. And if you've been listening to this podcast, you know that customer education leads to retention and revenue. So the Intellum platform gives you everything you need to educate your customers, partners, and employees on the products and services you sell. They've got a great platform. They've got Evolve as an authoring tool. And with Intellum, put it all together, you can deliver highly personalized and engaging learning experiences, give your customers a single destination for all their learning needs, and create and manage a wide range of content. So check them out today at try.intellum.com/CELabs. That's CELABS.
So you brought up some really good considerations here. One being this idea of it in general, like it's not, you can't say by fiat, this type of training should be free, this type of training should be paid. You have to look at what the other options are for the customer, right, including your competitors. You have to be able to look at the amount of training required to become productive with this product. And, you know, is training going to be enough of a value add that customers are going to have the price tolerance for it? And then actually building a business model around it, to your point, where especially if you're going to do subscriptions, the subscriptions need to be priced in a way where they're more attractive than the average a la carte version of the taking the same number of courses. And I would assume as well, kind of drawing on that, like you're thinking about multi-year subscriptions here, right? You want people to buy a training subscription and then renew it like a magazine for several years. But presumably, I mean, unless you had like a ton of advanced training, I would assume that they're probably taking on average more training in year one, when everyone's getting onboarded and doing implementation, then in year three, right?
Absolutely. And I would say by the time kind of I exited our, coordination with implementation was really strong, where training, here's the training you need to take before phase one, here's the training before phase two, here's the training before phase three. And so that consumption was very rigorous and had oversight. And so absolutely, year one is going to be the largest investment in training. And I would say early on, that's how sales sold it. They would sell, learn for a single year. There was even, because of the lack of buy-in, there were instances where the salesperson would say, I'm going to sell it to you for a year, it auto renews, but I'm going to put a reminder in my calendar to remind you of when to send in your cancellation letter. So going from that all the way, fast forward 8 years to where we had buy-in that compensation was tied to co-terming, meaning unless you sold Learn with the end date aligned to the product, then you weren't going to get comp for it. And any net new product sale was required to attach Learn. So we achieved, even before they said it was required, we got to an average of 95% attach for new deals. And I just went to our chief sales officer and I said, we're at 95%. I strongly believe that it is a rare exception that a customer can get through implementation without this. He's like, well, then make it mandatory. We know the value, right? But again, that goes back to there was 8 years of repetition, 8 years of him hearing positive customer stories, 8 years of like, that's not something I took lightly, his belief and faith in that. And I was so appreciative that he saw that bigger picture of, well, ultimately, we want to sell a 3-year deal with the sight of they will renew easily and it will be a non-event. And so this is one way that we do that. This is how we do that.
Yeah.
And so
tons.
I honestly think leading an education team, I mean, at least 50% of your job is internal enablement. And just perpetually, here's the value. Here's what we're doing. Please talk about this. Please point people this way. How do we get into that phase of the customer journey? How do we help you solve this problem? How do we know when the product is releasing something? How do we become best friends with the product managers? That level of integration, it's one of the things I love about the spot of education. I actually think education leaders a lot of times see the business more clearly than anyone else because they have to integrate in so many different places.
We are so cross-functional. Yeah.
So cross-functional. And I would be talking to a product and they would say, well, we're going to try this. And I'm like, you do know that's been tried with 3 other products and it's failed each time. And they're like, no. I'm like, go talk to these leaders. They can tell you what they've tried so that you can learn from them. Right. And it was this connective tissue of seeing, interpreting, putting together, providing value back to the business that then they provide that trust back to education.
I love that. And I think you're also hitting on something that a lot of education leaders underestimate or don't focus on is doing that internal enablement, that internal evangelism, providing our expertise back to the business. I myself don't do it nearly as much as I should be doing, because I think in education, we're in this situation where on one hand, what we do is not very well understood.
Right.
But on the counterpoint to that, people think they understand it, right? Like everyone has sort of an idea in their head about what education or training is. And so if you're not doing the work to really educate the business, then people aren't going to understand what you do and they're not going to know enough to know that they don't understand what you do. They're just going to fill in the gaps with whatever their idea of education or training is.
Yep.
So really, really like that point.
When I first started leading in education, I would think I needed to say something novel and interesting every time. And I'm like, oh, no, I don't. I just need to find the 3 things that are most important and say them in different, interesting ways, maybe throw in an analogy, maybe a dad joke to wake people's brains up and be like, wait, what? I'm here. But it's not going to stick. Like, what is it? You've got to repeat something 7 times before people might remember it. And I'm like,
how many times?
We're not there yet. Don't worry about it. We're gonna repeat it a few more times. And maybe by the end of this call, 7, lucky 7.
Okay.
exactly. Yeah. But realizing, oh, I lead education, but my job is actually to educate the other people I work with. And I cannot assume they understand the story. Do you know Joan Jett's I Love Rock and Roll?
I do.
So there's the I Love Rock and Roll, Put Another Dime in the Jukebox Baby. my daughter was learning this song and she put in juice box instead of jukebox and put another dime in the juice box, baby. And I'm like, why would she know what a jukebox is? She wouldn't, right?
Why unless you watched a lot of Happy Days on Nick at Night.
But why would these executives know how I run my business? If they knew how to run this business, I wouldn't have a job. They would just run it, right? So my job is to help them understand what we're doing and help them to care. I'm not saying that they are uncaring, but until they understand how it is important to the bigger picture and to those bigger numbers that they really care about and that they have to report to the street and the targets that are on their backs, then it's a nice to know, not a need to know.
Totally, totally. And like, I agree. It's really important. It brings us in as well to thinking about cross-functional collaboration. Sorry, I got distracted because I was also thinking about the fact that in I Love Rock and Roll, the thing that makes it rhythmically interesting is that there is one bar in the middle of the chorus where the time signature changes. And what it changes to is 7/4. It changes from 4/4 to 7/4. So yes. 7 truly is the magical number.
It's magic. And I like, thank you for going on the caveat with me and also like frolicking in the caveat with Joan Jett. And now we can come back. I appreciate it.
Okay, well, let's come back. I love, there's nothing I love more than stepping on a good transition. So now that I've done that, the thing that I would have been asking you about is you were talking about that influence with the sales team. And I would be curious to learn more about this. Like, how did you work with the sales team to sell and position your services? Did you have a dedicated education sales team, et cetera, et cetera? Like, tell me about that.
So when I joined, no. Then for a few years, yes. Then no. So they spun up a dedicated sales function for some of these smaller cross-sell, upsell opportunities. And it was incredibly successful. Like, we saw huge revenue percentage increases because, amazingly enough, when someone is focused on selling something, it gets sold more often.
Huh.
It's a radical idea. However, because this was a separate sales team that was selling their own little bag of cross-sell, upsell, A, that sales team had a lot of compensation on lower dollar items, but B, the customer experience. The customer felt like, well, I spoke to an AE, an AAE, an AAAAE, an AAAAAE. Like, they just felt like they were continually being sold to, and it was not the right way to go. And so, as at a corporate level, the decision was made like, hey, we're not going to do this like dedicated focus to sell these smaller cross-sell, upsell. And I said, great, understood. I want the customer experience to be a really good one. I do think this means that our revenue growth will slow dramatically because the opportunity to sell education then is very tied to when the seller is selling a new unit. And so we became, instead of like, this is a whole revenue stream in and of itself, our focus shifted to, we need to make sure we are making the best of every single time a product is sold, a product is renewed, a salesperson is having a conversation, a larger conversation, make it as easy as possible for them to include education in that conversation. And some of that was creating dashboards for them to have visibility for, does this customer actually own a Learn subscription for this product? It sounds so simple, but if a customer has professional services, SOWs, 5 different products, multiple different Learn subscriptions, going through line by line all of those SKUs, it took a decoder ring. And so I'm like, yeah, why are you going to try and sell something if you don't even know if they already own it? So making it easy to see, oh, this person doesn't have a Learn subscription, we're already talking to them about this, let's just add that on. Providing them sales, providing them enablement, providing them statistics, providing them cool, you know, emails or flyers, you know, making it as easy as possible for them. And pointing out, oh, look, did you know that most of the people at President's Club also sold the most Learn? because it increases your average sales point by X amount. So do you want to go to Presence Club? Maybe think about adding a Learn subscription, right? It's an easy way to increase the dollar that you're selling. The other really
for those of you who don't don't know as much about sales teams, President's Club is like the fancy trip that salespeople get to take, like the highest performers as like their incentive at the end of the year.
Highest performers go into Aruba or something like that. I've only ever seen the pictures, right? I've never been, but it's definitely a big motivator.
You're saying like the highest people going to President's Club are also the biggest sellers of Learn. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, you're good. And thank you. Decoder rings are important for when we stray into jargon land.
I got mine from the back of a cereal box.
And it works for customer education jargon? That's impressive. That's
weird, huh?
Cereal. The other piece would be, it was a gradual progression to get to where sales was selling Learn as a 3-year deal. Definitely started out as 1 year. And we saw that there were problems with that. You know, like this is not, our renewal rates for Learn were really low. Some of that was how it was positioned in sales. Some of it was that it was just coming up for renewal really quickly after go live. And so we said, okay, now you're only going to have sales comp if you sell a 2-year deal, right? So looking at and meeting with whoever puts together sales comp and saying, how does education fit into that comp scenario? Sales comp is a wild, wild west of information that it's a rabbit hole of detail. But understanding how your paid offering results in dollars for a salesperson can make or break whether it gets sold.
Yeah, true. I mean, if the incentives aren't there, then like it's not the thing that a salesperson is going to think about while they're working on a deal.
It's a hobby. It's no longer part of their job. Like that's not going to get them any comp. It's not.
Okay, but now you're hitting on something else, which is that often, even if it's part of the comp, an account executive is going to often choose to try to discount training or other one-off services, right? So that they can get the license deal done. So how did you handle that? Like what was going on with discounting?
So early on, it was sales desk, i.e. there's somebody reviewing every sale before it becomes final. Hey, flag anything over this percentage amount and reach out to myself or this other person or this other person. And end of quarter, end of year would just be a deluge of emails and frantic salespeople. And I need this. And and so that wasn't fun. Did not enjoy. Do not recommend. The thing that I found The thing that I found that worked is getting a large discount on software pricing, very difficult. So I would say, hey, whatever discount you have on the software, you can match it for the Learn sub. If you somehow manage to convince the CEO or the chief sales officer that this software should be sold at a 50% discount, great. Learn can be sold at a 50% discount because I am small potatoes compared to the product line. And by giving the deal desk and the sales managers and the sales teams that freedom, and for them to know, hey, as soon as something comes across with a 5% software, but a 10% Learn, it will get kicked back. I am not the way that you get to pass the finish line. If you cannot present the value that we are providing for the entire package, software and education, you can't eat into my margin in order to save your deal. So it's got to be equitable, right? And so that was a huge time saver. Honestly, end of quarter, end of year became blissfully quiet because there was a clear rule that everyone knew that they were going to have to play by, and there wasn't any ambiguity. Now, there were definitively moments where, hey, this really large software deal, they need education, but they will only ever have one user. Typically, this software has 7 to 10 users. They're only ever going to have one user for these reasons. can we get a larger discount on Learn? I would say yes, right? If it makes sense, if there is a business use case and you have had to run it up the chain already to get to me, great. I'm willing to play ball, but it becomes the exception, not the rule.
Yeah. And there has to be a good justification for it. Mm-hmm. That's really smart. I really like that. Okay. So we've sold the deal, and now we need to make sure that we can recognize the revenue and that we can make sure that our learners are consuming it. Right. And this is important because often, especially with a la carte, you can't actually recognize the revenue until there is some sign that the learner has consumed the course. So, like, tell me about that. How did you do revenue recognition? How are you monitoring uptake, consumption, all that good stuff?
So revenue recognition gets really simple when you're doing an all-you-can-eat subscription, because they sign the contract and then they, you know, here's the price for the year, divide it by 12. That's your monthly revenue and your MRR line. And that is what is recognized each month. The rev rec is completely separate from the subscription. And one of the things that I would have salespeople come to me and say, but they didn't use it at all for an entire year. We should give them a year for free, right? And I'm like, I can choose to not go to the gym for a year. That doesn't mean the gym is going to give me a free year subscription. They're going to say, you chose the sofa. That was your choice, right? So some of it is, hey, sales needs to understand we're not going to play that game. But the bigger piece was, I'm going to show sales that we are doing customer marketing, we're doing outreach, we're doing things to drive consumption, so that there isn't a customer saying, I didn't even know I had this. How would I know that I was paying for this? And so having monthly newsletters, making sure that we've got support to make sure that there's no issues logging into the LMS and there's no issues, making sure that there's a little bit of handholding of, are you getting the most out of your subscription? Let us help. We worked with the success teams that any kickoff call would position, here's the value of training. Let's log in. Are you logged in? Let's do a look around. That's not us, right? That was the success team at kickoff. And every single success manager knew how to do that. They knew how to talk about training. They knew to say, like, hey, you've got this. Let's get you in there using it. Here's a class we recommend. We were building out, a super high tech, just an Excel spreadsheet with, here are the main pain points. Here are the classes for those pain points. You hear that pain point, recommend this class, right?
Yeah. So you can still continue to drive meaningful consumption during the life cycle.
Correct. And so I think one of the keys for not having the discounting happen at the point of renewal was showing we're really driving and showing them the value and making sure that they are aware of what they can do. If they haven't taken anything, that's on them. The other piece was really, and it's kind of funny to say, but educating sales, because some of the sales leaders got it, but a lot of the sales folks just don't think this way. On if you give a discount on the subscription, it renews at that discounted rate. Or if the price suddenly jumps up, the customer doesn't think it's worth it. So you're making renewal more difficult by doing this discount at the front end. Oh, and if you've done an unrealistic discount, then you're actually below my cost point. And that means I'm running a nonprofit, which FYI, my boss is not a fan of. They don't want us to be a nonprofit. We support nonprofits. We don't act as one, right? Right. So
Because once you discount the price of the software, they're not thinking about the list price anymore. They're just thinking about what they're paying. That is now the cost of the software to the customer.
And there's the HelloFresh example of everybody signs up for the 50% off for the 3 weeks or 3 months, and then they cancel, and then maybe they try it again, right? The perceived value is now half as much. And so either my price needs to be different because my value doesn't support this price, or if the price is warranted, if the value is there, you need to do a better job of positioning it.
Yeah. So this kind of gets us to the last question that I want to ask. And I also want to leave some time at the end as well, if there's other things that we didn't get to that you want to talk about. But like, you were mentioning before, I think even maybe on the pre-show before we hit record, that you don't believe that monetization is the solution for everything. And I think what your last answer was getting into a little bit is that ultimately, when you're talking about education, pricing, and packaging, when you're talking about any monetized customer education program, you are really thinking about balancing these goals of revenue and margin for your education services operation with supporting the overall business, the overall software license, et cetera, right? It's kind of like revenue versus impact. So like, let's dig into that a little bit. I'm curious to learn more about this whole, perspective that monetization is not the end all be all, but also then how do you balance generating revenue with having some of that broader impact?
So this is something I'm passionate about. I don't think that there is a right or wrong answer. And a lot of it just depends on your customer base, your product, your business, what your leaders want. But I do think 10 years ago, or even 15, the expectation that education is going to be a higher price point, there's a very limited amount of free content, and you have to invest in order to learn the thing that you're purchasing. That was a much more accepted mainstream reality. We were also much closer to the on-prem days when education was a great upsell one-time opportunity because they paid for it already. It's on-prem. Like this, we're just going to educate you when you want, but we're going to charge a lot of money for it because you're kind of stuck with us. That has shifted dramatically. I mean, just look at Salesforce, right? They used to only run in-person boot camps and have a really long wait list. And they realized, you know what? It would be better for us to have a bunch of loyal users. And we're just going to launch Trailhead. And we know that it's going to be a huge investment every year, but it's going to pay off, right? And so to me, the most important thing is that as an education leader, you make sure your executives are looking at education as a long-term impact and value driver. I absolutely believe it can also be a revenue driver, but the trump card or the ace card should be, is there long-term value for the customer? And if the revenue stops the customer from renewing the product, right, then that's not the right revenue to make. In my opinion, I see the programs where there is a fair amount of free content and then the premium truly feels like premium. And that's what you pay for. Those are very interesting. And so if you're looking at, I mean, I think sometimes there's a line drawn between e-learning and instructor-led or hands-on, mm-hmm. having access to mm-hmm. sandboxes, having access to, you know, humans for office hours, right? The thing that is more costly to deliver is likely the premium thing, right? And so charging for it makes sense to people, but it's not getting in the way of them learning the product and being able to use the product. When you start to really need every single person to purchase education in order to use the product, that gets kind of dicey because essentially your enablement is hampered by your pricing strategy. So that's kind of my two cents. I think it's interesting when the premium is truly what is the revenue bearing. But I'll tell you, being a revenue center has a lot of luxuries in terms of being able to prove for investment, protecting your people and team, having the ability to say no, which is a beautiful, beautiful word. No is the ally of quality. That is something my team would hear a lot. We cannot say yes to everything. And when you are revenue center, it's much easier to say, hey, we could take this on, but then I've got to take effort away from this multi-million dollar revenue stream, don't think that's a good idea. So there's benefits as a leader to being a revenue center that I don't want to discount, but it's about the customer experience. It's about enablement, and it's about the long-term value of the customer and of the product.
Yeah. And probably to some extent, you also have to have either a product that is sufficiently complex that customers have price tolerance to pay for training on it. Or if you don't have that, then you need to have, to your point, something that feels either premium enough or differentiated enough that it's attractive to customers. So that could be, for instance, like investing in career development outside of the product itself. It could be super customized, I don't know, coaching or other value adds, right? Like you can monetize anything, but you have to know that there's sufficient customer demand and price tolerance for it.
And if you're at the very beginning and it's just, hey, we're about to stand up education, we're not going to charge for anything yet, but eventually we want to charge. Because I've talked to a lot of people that are in that spot. Really think about what you offer for free. Do you want that thing to be free long term? If not, maybe wait to launch it until you're ready to monetize. Because once something is free, taking candy away from the baby results in a lot of tears, and no one wants tears. So being proactive at that planning phase of these are my big dreams of everything we can do in education services in the next 5 years and we'll monetize 3 years from now, put some of those premium things that you think should be in the monetized bucket and don't build those first. Because if they're free for a couple of years, it's really hard to say, now you gotta pay for it.
Yeah, because also now you've anchored, it was sort of like you were talking about before, right? Like you've anchored expectations that the price for this thing is free.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is zero. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So before I start saying the magic words that make the closing music come on, what else would you like listeners to know that we haven't already covered, Mindy?
I would just say one thing that I have shared, and this is true for monetization as well, but in that category of measuring impact, I talk to so many folks that say, what do I measure? And I say, I will give you some examples of things to measure, but the most important thing is to figure out what does your business care about and what are they already measuring? Hitch your wagon to something that is already being measured. If you come up with the most beautiful measurement strategy, but it requires hours or weeks of work, and that work is only for your business, that's adorable. Like, it's never going to happen. Or if it happens, it then all lands on your shoulders. But taking something like product renewal, I promise you, your business is tracking product renewal. Then all you're doing is saying, hey, can we overlay training consumption or certification completion on top of that product renewal? Not, hey, can you go pull completely separate data for me? And I started off with the completely separate data asks, and it was, you know, pulling teeth and climbing mountains, which is a horrible combination, by the way. Don't do those two things at the same time.
Mm-hmm. But take that combo package.
Yeah, really bad combo. Very stressful. But realizing, oh, everybody's overworked, right? Everybody has too much on their plate. So how do I get my effort into the flow of what's already happening? If that helps save someone some blood, sweat, and tears, I will be very happy.
Very sage advice. And if a listener wants more sage advice from you in the capacity of consulting,
yes,
how should they get in contact with you?
Look me up on LinkedIn. So I am the only Mindy Barenblatt worldwide. Before I got married, I searched for Mindy Barenblatt and Google said, there are no results. And I thought, oh, I better be on my best behavior. So Mindy Barenblatt on LinkedIn is a great way to find me. And I do tend to post about customer education as well as mindfulness and surviving corporate life in a mindful way.
Very cool. And if there are any other Mindy Barenblatts listening, now is the time to reveal yourselves. because you are unfindable anywhere on the interwebs. If you, listener, want to learn more, not just about Mindy Barenblatt, but about all the topics that we talk about, we have a podcast website at customer.education. You can find show notes, other material, other great resources. And please, if you found value in this podcast, please share it with your friends. We love it when people post on LinkedIn and actually talk about what they learned in a given episode. And I think this episode, there was a ton to learn. So tag us in your posts. Let us know your reactions. Let us know if you disagree with anything that we talked about, because pricing is a super contentious topic. It's spicy, as we like to say. And thank you to Alan Coda for the theme music that is probably playing under me right now. It's not playing in real life for us, but it's probably playing on the edited podcast. And you're probably already subscribed, but what we'd really appreciate is if you could go to Apple Podcasts. I know we say this every time, so maybe we can like snap out of it, like take out your phone right now, go to Apple Podcasts, click 5 stars, and then write some things about the podcast. Please, please, please. That really helps share our show with the rest of the world. Mindy, thank you so much for joining today. It was great talking to you.
This was really fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you to our audience as well for joining us. Go out and educate, experiment, and find your people. Thanks for listening.